Now I leave the floor to Renaud Filliol of Lille University CNRS. His speech is entitled Methodological Individualism, Sociology of Knowledge and Cognitive Sociology. Please.
So thank you very much for this invitation and for the participation to this beautiful work on methodological. So I was asked to write a chapter on the thematic of sociology of knowledge and cognitive sociology. This chapter is under the header, if I may say so, of Raymond Boudon's quotation, for all those who adhere to the principles and so on, can only be explained insofar as it makes sense for an ideal typical subject. This is really the core of the chapter, if it can be summarized in just one sentence. And my main thesis is that the sociology of knowledge, of course, greatly benefits from the application of an individualistic methodology. So in this chapter, I give an overview of sociology of knowledge in a historical perspective. And I begin with the classic paper by Robert Merton, 1945, The Sociology of Knowledge. And Merton gives a very good summary of what was known about the sociology of knowledge at the time. And he asks three questions that seem to him to summarize, to present the paradigm of the sociology of knowledge in his time. So the first question, I've forgotten to ask, how much time do I have?
You have 25.
So the first question, where is the existential basis of mental production located? Then what mental productions and how are the mental productions related to the existential basis? The first question, of course, Merton presents the ideas of Marx and Engels, so relations of production, class position. There is Scheler, of course, who invented, forged the term sociology of knowledge, and Scheler finds the existential basis in what he calls the real factors, impulses of sex, hunger, and power. Then you have, of course, Karl Mannheim, a very famous contributor to the sociology of knowledge, and he insists more on the group belonging, the generation, the status, the occupational group, and so on. And an important example also is Durkheim and Maus, on the forms of representation, and they find the basis for mental productions in social rights, the group structure, the spatial configuration of gatherings, all right, in Australian tribe and so on. Then the second question, what mental productions are sociologically analyzed? We have, of course, ideology, and on this question, the hot topic, so to speak, is the scientific knowledge. Is sociology of knowledge able to explain scientific knowledge, especially of the hard sciences? And Karl Mannheim, for instance, thought that the exact sciences, that's how we call them, were exempted from an existential determination. The most important question, however, is probably the last question. What is the relationship between mental productions and the existential basis? And on this very foundational question, Merton, in his paper of his 1945 papers, he observes that the various authors, Marx, Durkheim and Mauss, and so on, Mannheim, are not really very explicit, do not give a detailed explanation or a detailed account of this relationship between mental productions and the existential basis. And for him, this is the weak point of sociology of knowledge. At the time, for instance, about the Durkheim and Mauss theory of categories, the categories of thought, Merton said that Durkheim and Mauss's contribution is a naive theory of correspondence. So there is a correspondence between the categories and the way the social gatherings are organized, but this is just a naive correspondence, and there is no real explanation of the relationship between the sociological organization phenomena and the mental phenomena. So next, I take an example that I borrow from Boudon, from Raymond Boudon also, and it's simply trying to explain a collective belief. Because one of the problems I find in Merton's contribution is that he never tries really to explain collective belief. So let's take an example of a very simple collective belief. And what is it? What does it mean to explain it? How can we explain it? So machines create mass unemployment, the famous question of the influence of machinery, mechanization, and so on, on unemployment. All right. So when we want, without necessarily going deep into theoretical or methodological consideration, when we want to explain this, we find quite easily why a lot of people, not everyone, but a lot of people will tend to believe that machines indeed create mass unemployment and are a risk for society and for the economy. The explanation could go this way. So machines, of course, perform many tasks much faster and better than human labor. And in order to be more productive, so the firms tend to replace human labor by machines. So they replace, of course, workers by machines, then they fire the workers. And since more and more firms mechanize, use machinery, right, the job opportunities become smaller and smaller. And so there are less and less job openings. And at the end, we should have mass unemployment, a massive unemployment. Maybe people would answer that indeed machines create or risk creating mass unemployment. Maybe they are not performing such a detailed explanation. But it should be something like that in their mind, and they would conclude, as a consequence, a conclusion of their reasoning, that indeed machines create mass unemployment or risk creating massive unemployment. So this explanation is typical. It's an explanation of a widespread belief, and a sociological explanation in at least three respects. So this was very simple. So first, we have just explained, I think satisfactorily, a collective belief, so an important sociological phenomenon. This belief depends on a social economical context, of course. In order to have this kind of beliefs, you need to have capitalism, you need to have machines, you need to have creative destruction and things like that. And furthermore, people will tend to believe this idea more if there is rising unemployment or if, as today, there is an innovation that risks destroying a lot of jobs. As today, the artificial intelligence, right, that may indeed destroy thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of jobs. So again, right now we are speaking about the risk that machines might create unemployment. This is the social economical context. And people may also have a direct experience in society of the fact that machines destroy employment. For instance, the self-ordering kiosk in fast food restaurants, the cashiers who are replaced by self-checkouts at stores, and so on and so forth. So we have an explanation by reasons. This, of course, belongs to methodological individualism. Why? Because we go back to the individual in a social context, right? And we explain why the individual believes what he believes in this context. So the problem with the classical approach, when we compare it with this very, very simple, very straightforward reasoning that people perform to believe such a thing, that machines create mass employment. The problem with the classical approach is that, as Merton summarizes it, they try to account for a relationship, to highlight a relationship between a sociological substratum and mental productions. And Raymond Boudon, in L'Idéologie, 1986, adopts a very different approach, which is explanatory. The question is not an abstract question about a relationship between two phenomena. The problem is to explain. And I think this changes the perspective and is much more fruitful than the classical approach. So we try to explain a widespread belief. Why do many people believe this? So we are right away in an explanatory framework, not trying to find some relationship. What does it mean? Can be anything. No, we want to explain. And the explanation here is very simple. Why do people believe in some proposition, some given a certain proposition? Because they make a reasoning that can be very simplistic, that can be erroneous. Here the reasoning is erroneous. Okay, so they make a reasoning and they conclude. And they believe the conclusion because they have made a reasoning that leads them to the conclusion that indeed, for instance, machines create mass unemployment. So the question here that we had here, how are mental productions related? You know, I think the question is badly put. We just have a sociological phenomenon, which is a collective belief, and we want to explain it. So we explain through human cognition, human reasoning, and furthermore, we have here a very good example of a belief that is probably, in all the past context anyway, wrong. It is wrong to say that machines will create mass unemployment. We will see what happens with artificial intelligence, but I don't think it will create mass unemployment. It will be a shock. Creative destruction, so there is destruction, but there is also creation. And this is very well explained in the Austrian theory, for instance, the theory of the Austrian school. We have a very good explanation of how jobs move from one sector to another following technical shocks and so on and so forth. So I will not go into the detail here, but it is obvious that people who believe that machines create mass unemployment are not able, do not have an economic expertise, so they are not able to make the correct deduction taking into account the complexity of the system. So they focus on a part of the system, they see jobs disappearing, and indeed jobs are disappearing, and then they generalize, and they do not realize because it's a complex system, a multi-step reasoning, right? They don't realize that in fact other jobs will be created, and at least as much jobs as have been destroyed, and furthermore, with jobs with a higher productivity. So in fact, machines are extremely beneficial if we take the material well-being of humanity into account. So following this part on Merton and this part on the concrete explanation of collective belief, I have tried to distinguish the methodological individualistic approach with other approaches, beginning with polylogism. So first, I have methodological individualism versus polylogism. The explanation through methodological individualism, of course, relies heavily on reason, on reasoning, on human reason. So there is a fundamental question. Could it be that reason, human reason itself, is sociologically determined and various societies, right, from various societies or societal organizations emanate various kinds of reasons, various kinds of human reasons? Very fundamental question, of course. And this question was described by Ludwig von Mises as polylogism. The idea that there are multiple logical systems, heteronous forms of reasoning and logical systems. Of course, here the reference to Lévi-Bruhl and primitive mentality is obvious, and it's interesting that both Raymond Boudon and Ludwig von Mises devoted quite a lot of considerations on this author. Raymond Boudon really categorized Lévi-Bruhl and primitive mentality as an irrationalist or a-rationalist explanation. And von Mises, he was, I think he had read, it was later, he had read the later work by Lévi-Bruhl, so he was more more favorable to Lévi-Bruhl's thesis. And Lévi-Bruhl, in his later work, recognized that, in fact, the structure of the mind, that's the expression he uses, is universal. There is just one structure of the mind, and there are ways of thinking within this structure. So maybe after being labeled irrationalist or an irrationalist theory, maybe at the end of these of his works, he was more of, to some extent, or maybe to a large extent, a critic also of polylogism. So the cognitive bias have been evoked this morning, so I will not spend a lot of time here. Are cognitive biases a sign of prelogical mentality or of subjective rationality? Indeed, Raymond Boudon has very convincingly shown on multiple examples that this is not the case. They are an instance of subjective rationality. Maybe no need to go further on this point. And I have here a series of quotes against polylogism that I found in Weber, Popper, Mises, Boudon, so really the main, the most important supporters of methodological individualism. So in Weber, the example of the Chinese, the scientific proof must be acknowledged as correct even by the Chinese. So this is the idea that culture, science is not cultural dependent, science is not society dependent, science is a universal endeavor. Popper speaks of the unity of human reason, and he said that if human reason was not unique, we could not speak with one another between societies. We could not speak between us, between different societies. Then Mises, of course, I like this one, uniformity and immutability of the logical structure of the human mind. And Boudon, it was in French, I translated, universalité des règles de fonctionnement de la pensée. So there is an unanimity. The supporters of methodological individualism completely, totally reject polylogism. All right. Then we have, of course, methodological individualism versus false consciousness. My neighbor here is smiling. So there is this very famous quotation by Engels in a letter to Franz Mehring about whether the term false consciousness appears for the first time. Marx himself never used it. So ideology is a process accomplished consciously, but with false consciousness. The real motive forces impelling him remain unknown to him. Otherwise, it would not be an ideological process. And on this matter, I like very much the example that Raymond Boudon takes in L'Idéologie. It shows that the explanation of commodity fetishism that you find in Marx is a counterexample to the idea of a false consciousness. It shows that, in fact, the way Marx explained the belief in the law on supply and demand, so Marx thought that the law of supply and demand was wrong because the prices were determined by the quantity of labor. So he wanted to explain, why do people believe in the law on supply and demand? And he had the idea of commodity fetishism. I won't go into the detail, but I've read carefully Marx's text on this matter, and I think that Raymond Boudon is perfectly on point. The explanation of commodity fetishism that you find in Karl Marx in Capital, Volume 1, is indeed a rational explanation and an explanation in terms of methodological individualism. Right? Then, later, much later, in the early 1970s, you have the appearance of the strong program in sociology of knowledge. And the main author, probably, is David Brohr, Knowledge and Social Imagery. And he wanted to define, so, a paradigm in sociology of knowledge based upon causality, impartiality, symmetry, and reflexivity. Most important here is causality, because what David Brohr means by causality is causality of social forces external to the actor and psychological forces. So we think that beliefs, and including scientific beliefs, including mathematical beliefs, are caused by an external sociological situation and also, he says, by psychological states. So by sociology and psychology. But the sociology David Breuer is talking about is only the Durkheimian sociology. So reading him, rereading him for this paper, I realized that David Breuer seems to completely ignore that there is a Weberian sociology. He doesn't seem to realize that there is a sociology that starts from the actor and the rationality of the actor. There's just the Durkheimian paradigm, you know, external sociological forces impinge on the act, on the subject, the individual, and causes the beliefs, including the scientific beliefs. Right? So this is very strange because we are here gathered to celebrate, so to speak, methodological individualism, Weberian sociology, and a paradigm that is ubiquitous, not only in sociology, but also in anthropology with Robin Horton, and in economics, of course. And David Breuer, in the 1970s, writes in sociology as if there was only the Durkheimian paradigm. Furthermore, I would say that his paradigm is inconsistent because he criticized the idea that reasons can cause beliefs, but he tries to convince us of the validity of his theory through reasons. So he uses reasons to convince us that beliefs are not caused by reasons. I think that this is clearly an inconsistency. So then in his reasoning, he opposes the causal model and the theological model. Maybe I won't go into this kind of detail. And then, before the cognitive turn that was triggered by Boudon in the mid-1980s, you have, of course, social constructivism. Bruno Latour and Steve Wolgar, Laboratory Life, 1979. This is very, very bad. Very bad book. Interesting, provocative, but does not hold water. So, for these authors, as you may know, there's no external reality. There's no external reality. External reality is constructed in the laboratory by the interactions between the scientists and the scientists and their machines. So, the curves that go out on the papers of the machine, this is constructed reality, truly constructed by the interaction between the scientist and the machine. This is very weird. And it was Latour who had made an ethnographic, this is not ethnography in fact, but let's call it ethnographic study in a biology lab where the responsible of this lab later earned a Nobel Prize in biology, so very important work. And he concluded that, no, there are just social processes. Oh, no. So there's no objective reality, there is no rational discussion. These factors, according to Latour, do not exist and do not play any role. And one of the main arguments that they advance to defend their thesis is that scientific facts can be deconstructed. So how do we know that they are pure social constructions? And they say it's because they can be deconstructed. There is an obvious objection if they are deconstructed, and indeed, many facts are deconstructed afterwards, but they had not been constructed. They had not been constructed. Reality had not been constructed. So scientific activity appears as a totally senseless activity where we construct, but we deconstruct, and where is it going? What are we doing? Scientific activity appears totally absurd, baseless, and without any objective in this conception. And I compare the individualism, methodological individualism with the social constructivism. So social constructivism is characterized by estrangement and hubris. Estrangement because they want to make the activities of the scientists appear as different or as strange as possible to us. This is not the ethnographic method. In fact, the ethnographic method is exactly the opposite. What the anthropologists do when they are visiting and studying, you know, societies, very traditional societies, very different from ours, what are they doing? They are trying to make a connection, a correspondence, a comparison between what happens in these very different societies and what exists in our society. For example, in these traditional societies, this is what in our society is art, or this is what in our society is science. So they make something that is very strange initially, in fact, understandable and close to us. And what Latour and Woolgar do is exactly the reverse. They take scientific activity, which is something we understand, we study, we observe, and we conclude, and they make it as strange as possible. So that's why a while ago I said ethnographic study, because I don't think this is ethnography at all. This is the opposite of ethnography, of good ethnography. And hubris, because they think they know better than scientists and philosophers what reality is. When sociologists do not have to, they're not supposed, they are not philosophers, they are not supposed to know what reality really is. And on the other side, of course, you have understanding and humility. I think I have to go faster. So this quotation by Merton really summarizes the sociology of knowledge, the idea that there is a dual explanation. You have rational beliefs explained by reasons, and you have irrational beliefs explained by sociology, right? And we find the exact same take, the exact same stance, in an excellent epistemologist called Larry Loudon. The sociology of knowledge may step in to explain beliefs if and only if these beliefs cannot be explained in terms of their rational merits. So there is a whole line of thought between, you know, sociologists, great sociologists like such as Merton, and a great epistemologist, you know, with this idea of duality in explanation. And I think the cognitive approach by Boudon completely explodes this duality. No, there is no duality. There is unity. When we want to explain a belief, we need to take into account the cognition of the actor, socially situated. So the two, the cognition and the situation, are inextricably linked. You cannot say there is cognition, this is for epistemologists, and there is the social context for sociologists. No, these two sentences, in my opinion, are completely wrong and really an erroneous approach of the problem. And I finished the paper with this table, you know, types of explanation, types of knowledge. So on the left you have the explanations, rational or irrational through social factors, and the types of knowledge, true or validated, or false or questionable. And you find on the lower row the modern sociology of knowledge of Bloor, Latour, and so on, and the classical sociology of knowledge. Well, do not take this table too seriously. I mean, it's more heuristic, you know, than perfectly calibrated table. So it's just to give a rough idea of the domain. And it's a kind of map that is not perfect. We could be lost at some point on this map. And with this, I thank you very much for your attention.
Question.